Hello, it's Monday, February the 8th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up in the programme, we're going to be talking about pigs. There's an awful lot of them stuck on farms because they can't be sold to the European Union. Is Brexit to blame? Could TV be the answer to soothing stressed-out cats and entertaining bored dogs? More food for my stressed cats, that's what works for me. University graduates and former graduates, they're getting stuck in helping school kids with their online teaching. But first, illegal immigrants may be granted an amnesty to help them get COVID jabs, but apparently they won't be jumping any queues. Illegal immigrants will be granted an amnesty to come forward for COVID jabs in an effort to help Britain reach herd immunity. That's according to a report in today's Daily Mail. Now, no official account exists for the number of people with what the Home Office describe as irregular status, but some estimates put the figure as high as 1.3 million. Which is an awful lot of people. Joining me to discuss this is Satbir Singh, who's Executive Director of the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants. Mr. Singh, do you have any clue how many illegal immigrants there are in Britain?
Well, the fact that people are undocumented makes it quite difficult to determine that number. Looking at all the estimates that are out there, it's safe to say that there are hundreds of thousands of people in the UK, many of whom will have been here for a very long time, living with their families in our communities, working in our key roles and frontline work. And it's really, really important that just like everybody else, when it's their turn, according to that list published by JCVI, that they get vaccinated as well, because it's the safest way for all of our communities to be safe.
I get that, of course, and everybody wants everybody to be safe and healthy. But when you say they're working in the normal way, are they working in the sense that they're working and paying any national health insurance and income tax, or are they working in what we still call the black economy? Because I thought, as illegal immigrants, they couldn't work legitimately.
Well, people who are undocumented in the UK don't have any recourse to public funds or public support.
Right.
So if people are here, they will be working to provide for themselves, to stay alive, or to provide for their families. The problem, the real challenge right now, it's been a problem for many years, but it's been a particular problem during the pandemic, is that because the law prohibits them from working, and it's much more likely to punish them rather than an employer, many of those people will be in what we might call exploitative work. So they might be working in warehouse factories. They might even be working in delivery services and things like that. It's really important that those people doing those jobs are able to get vaccinated.
Do that. I'm still curious about that. It's not a criticism, but I'm just trying to get to understand it, Mr. Singh. Do they pay income tax and national insurance on this work they're doing, or are they doing it under the counter, if you like, what we call the black economy? They're being perhaps paid cash in hand or in some other way.
Well, for most people who are in that situation, they'll be existing in, you know, the grey or black economy. They'll be working in exploitative sectors.
Yeah. Some people, of course, then would argue, and you know where I'm going with this conversation, I'm sure. Well, if they haven't paid any money into the system, how are they then going to get stuff out of the system in the terms of the jab and other NHS treatment?
Well, we all want this pandemic to be over. We all want to come out of lockdown. We all want there to be widespread immunity. We know that the safest and quickest way to do that is through vaccination. I think if we go down the route of topping up what people have or haven't paid into a system, it's a very unhealthy direction, because there'll be plenty of people in all sorts of different walks of life who might, by that kind of conversation, be counted out. And the safest way to make sure everybody is safe is to make sure that as many people as possible are vaccinated, regardless of what their backstory is, regardless of where they've come or how they've come to be here. We're only safe, really, from the virus when everybody's safe.
It isn't a part of the problem you're going to have as Executive Director of the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants. A number of these people are going to be too scared to come forward because they are here illegally. And while they may get their jab, somebody in the Home Office or the Border Force may think, oi, I've been looking for that bloke or that woman for a very long time. And then they boot them out of the country.
It's a real problem. And what we found throughout the pandemic and even before the pandemic is many, many people who have irregular status, and many people who have regular status are scared to access healthcare. Our survey, which was done recently and is being published today, found that more than 40% of the people we surveyed were scared to go to a doctor because we have all sorts of policies in place, including a data sharing arrangement with the Home Office. Now, what we found over the years, and the Windrush scandal is a great example of this, is that the Home Office will not necessarily give up those powers willingly. And it's short-sighted at this point for them to maintain those, because if the goal is to make sure that as many people are vaccinated as possible, they need to back their announcement today up with some ironclad guarantees that say for the next 12 months, if you go to the doctor, your data won't be handed over. And then, you know, give people the confidence that they need to go out and protect themselves, their families, their communities.
But how do you convince them that that's going to happen and that they can trust that guarantee?
It's a difficult challenge, right? It's a real challenge because, you know, the Home Office, the government, for various reasons over the years, have found it quite difficult to build that trust. I mean, you know, when the Windrush scandal broke 3 years ago and the government said people should come forward, we'll help them, we'll support them, it was really difficult to build trust, and organizations like ours had a role to play in doing that. What we would need to see are those ironclad guarantees from government that data won't be shared. And then with partners, the government can, of course, try to build that trust so that people come forward.
Just finally on that, I mean, you mentioned Windrush. The difference is, of course, the people from Windrush were here legally. The people we're talking about here, they're here illegally. They're in breach of the law, aren't they?
Well, the way the law works in this country is, regardless of whether you're here legally or not,
but they are in breach of the law, aren't they?
If you don't have the right papers at the right time, you face this sort of trouble. So many of those people will have been here for a long time. Many of them will have the right to stay here. They've just never been processed properly through that system. Others will have fallen out of status, but come here perfectly legally at different points. Others may have been trafficked or smuggled into the UK and be working in the grey economy. It's really important that regardless of that journey, however people came here, that they are vaccinated when their time comes up to be vaccinated.
Okay, that's Satbir Singh, who is the Executive Director of the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show, free and in full, along with our other podcasts, and we've got quite a few of them, and our video series too. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So as children lose months of education due to school closures, university students have been apparently stepping into the breach, offering free tuition to help them keep up. The charity Tutor the Nation is operating as a pilot scheme in Bolton and aims to roll this out nationwide. I'm joined by, I'm delighted to say, Nathaniel McCulloch, who's a trustee at Tutor the Nation, and he's also founder of Simply Learning Tuition. Mr. McCulloch, it's a great idea. Graduates students at universities, they've got a bit of spare time on their hands. How did you manage to harness it?
Well, it was really, I think, Jackie Lambert's energy in terms of coming up with the idea in the first place, and then consulting four sort of arch enemies in the tutoring world who we're all good friends really, but we run quite competitive companies. And she had the brainwave of getting us all together and finding out really how we recruit our tutors and finding out where they come from and what makes a really good tutor. And I think the universal comment there is that the best quality of a tutor is to actually be able to empathize with their students. And naturally, undergrads or recent graduates are really good at that because they're so close to having done the exams themselves, and they understand the rigors and the pressures. And often it's not just the academic work. So it's not just a case of explaining to a student how you sort of do long, complicated formula calculations or investigated text in an English essay or anything like that. It's actually just showing them that they're not silly not to understand it, and that perhaps it wasn't explained clearly at the time in school, or they weren't fortunate enough to have any extra support at home to help explain things. So often a tutor that's similar in age, maybe just a couple of years older than the student, can be absolutely brilliant. And I think that's what Jackie took from speaking to the four companies who were involved in the setup. And then she went on to essentially bring in Roz Llewellyn, who used to work with us at Simply Learning, and she's adept at finding the best tutors from all the people that apply. So Roz was able to sift through the large number of applications and pick out the ones that we thought were really good.
Okay, and Jackie Lambert, of course, she was an investment banker. She's a mother of two. She was literally just, I think, listening to the radio, and she thought, actually, why can't these newly qualified graduates or currently undergraduates get involved? Why? And this morphed into Tutor the Nation, and that is piloting in Bolton. Mm-hmm. Was there a reason you chose Bolton, Mr. McCulloch, in particular?
Yeah, that was Charles Bonus's idea, actually. Charles runs Bonus McFarlane Tuition, and he's another trustee. And he had heard that Bolton was an area of particularly high numbers of disadvantaged children. So that's technically that's children on free school meals, but essentially means children that just don't have the support, and where the schools are finding it tough to bring in additional support. So he suggested that to Jackie in the first instance. And I think from our side, we're very, very heavy on safeguarding with this charity. So one of the other trustees, Lucy Corkwell, who runs Osborne Corkwell Tuition, is a safeguarding specialist, as am I. And so we thought that the best thing to do would be to go to a council, and instead of going to individual schools or parents, actually go to a proper LEA who are, you know, highly regulatory, and say, we've got this wonderful charity, but we really want to test it and almost have it rubber stamped by you to prove that it can work and that it can really hit the safeguarding standards that are needed.
Mm. And you've signed up, I think, 4,500 voluntary tutors, and you've already delivered 35,000 hours of teaching. Has one of the problems your volunteers may have encountered been access to iPads, computers? I don't know if you know, but the Mail's been running a campaign to raise money for that area. And also, of course, some children's parents may not have the best broadband facilities for online teaching, not least because they can't afford it.
Well, I think absolutely. Andrew, if I could just go back to the beginning of your question, the fantastic number of hours you've listed there actually haven't all been delivered by Tutor the Nation.
Right.
What happened is we Jackie rolled in something called the Coronavirus Tutoring Initiative, which is a genius scheme set up by Jacob Kelly, who's a final year undergrad at Oxford. And over the summer last year, he managed to deliver a good sort of three quarters of those numbers you described on his own efforts. And what happened is when Jackie set this up, Jacob got in touch with him and said, look, I'm doing something really similar. Would you be interested in collaborating? So Jacob has come on board to help set up Tutor the Nation along with the trustees and Jackie. And I think the additional work that we've done has really only just started. So because we were doing the trial at Bolton, we put everything into getting that right.
Mm.
So the number of hours we've delivered so far have been in the low hundreds as opposed to the high thousands. And we've just rolled Jacob's wonderful work into ours. But onto the second point, you're absolutely right. The paucity of decent electric equipment and useful broadband access is a problem, but obviously because all the tuition has to be done online now with the lockdown.
Yes.
And I think your campaign, the Daily Mail campaign to try and get laptops, iPads, whatever digital devices can be given is fantastic. And, you know, I'm pretty sure everyone's got something kicking around at home that could be of great use for a student. I mean, all they need is access to the internet. They don't, you know, the software that we're using is proprietary and it's quite specialist. It helps with the safeguarding. It just makes the delivery of your lessons as efficient as possible. But even without it, for children to have access to Zoom or hopefully something a bit more secure means that they can start learning. And it doesn't have to be a super duper, you know, powerful computer. It just has to be something quite simple.
Good stuff. And that Daily Mail campaign is about to be stepped up even more. So watch that space. Look, well done with your campaign. That's Nathaniel McCulloch. He's trustee at Tutor the Nation and he's founder of Simply Learning Tuition, which is doing great work with kids who are struggling at home with their schoolwork. Thanks for joining us. Britain's 10,000 pig farms have been left in limbo thanks to EU bureaucracy. That's according to the National Pig Association. Since January, no pork has crossed the channel, with each pig now requiring 72 pages of documentation if sold in the EU. Is this a consequence of Brexit? I'm joined now by Rebecca Veal, who's Senior Policy Advisor at the National Pig Association. That's a lot of bureaucracy, Rebecca, 72 pages. That will presumably, if you want to use a farming analogy, cheese off your members.
It certainly is. And currently what that means is that only 25% of exports that should be going over to the EU are at the moment, and that is pork exports I'm talking about. And the importance of our exports is that they provide carcass balance. So the parts of the carcass that we don't necessarily want to eat in this country, we export. So they have a market, which is good for the environment, and it's good for the balance that we're required in terms of when we're producing pigs. And so the bureaucracy and the very limited amount of pork that's currently being exported is having massive implications. When you add COVID into the mix and a poor pig price at the moment, it's very, very challenging for farmers.
And what is happening if they're not selling as much as they were, if they're not exporting as much as they were to the European Union, Rebecca, that the pigs stay on the farm, the farmers don't get paid. How long can the pigs stay on the farm? I mean, can they stay indefinitely? They've got to be fed, presumably. And farmers need the cash.
Absolutely. So at the moment, we believe for figures from AHDB, which is the levy board, predict there's about 100,000 pigs on farm that should have been through the abattoir by now. That's a lot of pigs, and that kind of number takes a long time to get through. And when you produce a pig, you produce it to a certain specification. So our processors in this country will pay a certain amount for that pig. But when you get a pig that has been on farm longer, they come out of that specification. They get more fat, they put on more weight, and therefore producers are then financially penalised for that. So they're actually getting paid less for that pig. And feed prices are a lot higher at the moment, so it's incredibly costly for producers. And in fact, producers don't expect to make a profit. They are expecting to make a loss in the first quarter of this year.
Now, is this, Rebecca, do I dare use the dreaded B word, is this a consequence of Brexit or not?
So Brexit isn't helping the issue. We obviously have some COVID-related problems in the sector, so abattoirs are running slower at the moment. We've talked about this before in terms of labour shortages, staffing off with COVID and...
Yeah.
Etc. So that's caused some pressure. The price is also really poor at the moment, and as I mentioned, the input prices are much higher, so feed costs and straw, which is really important for pig welfare, they are much higher at the moment. And then you add into the mix EU exit. So the exports have slowed significantly into the EU, which is a market that we're reliant on. The cost in terms of sending pork across to the EU is much higher, and there are a huge amount of more checks being taking place, 30% more in fact. There was some uncertainty over the requirements, so we've kind of been messed around with regard to that in terms of some of the testing that was required. And our official vets are, in all honesty, struggling to keep track with the volume of the export health certificates and paperwork required for loads to go. And when the UK government is making sure that imports are coming in really well, our pork is then competing against pork that's produced to a lower standard, but has also not undergone any of these extra costs or bureaucracy that we have.
So now,
it's very challenging.
Yeah. And is this, Rebecca, we always knew there were going to be bumps in the road when we left the European Union in various elements. You know, there's all sorts of problems going on with getting food into Northern Ireland. Are these problems you think that can be ironed out with the extra bureaucracy, for instance, or is this now the permanent state of affairs for your industry?
Some of those things are permanent, you know, the requirements in terms of export health certificates, you know, they are a legal requirement as we are now a third country. But it could be smoothed out significantly, and particularly with the assurances that the EU will have in terms of the standard of production that we have in this country. And so, yeah, absolutely, it could be streamlined significantly.
You've got an open line, I imagine, to the Secretary of State for the Environment, George Eustace. Is it? Do you sense that ministers are listening to your pleas for help here? Because the industry's clearly got problems.
We'd been calling for help for quite some time in terms of getting them to keep track of what was going on, and particularly around at the beginning of the year and the build-up to the beginning of the year. And we'd been asking for more support and for them to be engaged in these challenges. We did ask the Secretary of State for a round table, and thankfully he has now agreed, which will, and that will take place tomorrow. Minister Prentice will be hosting that. At that forum, we need to work through what we're going to do with the pigs that we've got on farm. We need engagement throughout the supply chain. So, for instance, retailers, how could they support and recognise their commitments to British pork? And then we need DEFRA to help ease some of these issues that we have in terms of our exports. And also we are asking DEFRA to consider prioritising food processing workers for the vaccine. Now, I'm not asking us to go ahead of the NHS, but looking at in terms of risk and making sure we still have pork on our shelves in the shops, I think protecting the workforce that are producing food is really, really important.
I can ask you just two more things, if you don't mind. Is there any way the surplus of pigs on your farms, can you sell more to butchers, supermarkets in this country? Is there capacity they could absorb? And is this, if this situation isn't resolved, Rebecca, do you suspect some of your members will think to hell with this and we'll just give it all up?
So in terms of retailers and the ability for pork to hit the UK market, absolutely. We know from Kantar data that pork is flying off the shelves in the shops at the moment. UK consumers recognise it's a healthy meat to include within a balanced diet, which is wonderful. And we would like to see that continue, and support from supermarkets to put British pork on the shelves where they can would be great. Recognising that not every part of the carcass is going to be demanded by our UK consumers, but there's a huge place for British pork on the shop shelves, absolutely. In terms of what happens if we don't create get rid of the black backlog of pigs that are on farm at the moment, we're getting very close to seeing welfare issues, and we absolutely do not want to see that. And the next course of action is if pigs were to get stuck on farm and we couldn't get them to the abattoir and processed, then would be a welfare cull, and they would be culled on farm. Now, obviously, when that happens, the meat doesn't enter the food supply chain, and therefore that has an environmental cost as well as a financial cost for that producer.
Well, let's hope we don't get to that point. And the very best of luck with your meeting with the Minister tomorrow. That's Rebecca Veal. She's Senior Policy Advisor at the National Pig Association. Thanks for joining us. If you enjoy The Andrew Pearce Show, why don't you subscribe to us? Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify. And if you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at Tory Boy Pearce. It's that time of the programme. Matt Gatwood, Deputy Sports Editor, is here with the latest from the world of sport. I think your prediction's going to be wrong about who's going to win the championship. You told me it was going to be Liverpool.
I did not.
You did.
Are you sure?
And your deputy mate, Tim, said it was going to be Manchester City.
I'm pretty sure I said Man City from
you did
the
not.
Start.
You did not.
Okay, well, I'm definitely going to be wrong then.
Didn't Manchester City have a stunning victory at Anfield on
Sunday? Yesterday, yeah. Amazing performance, yeah. They absolutely smashed them in the end. There were some errors made by the Liverpool goalkeeper, Alisson. But Phil Foden, the Man City youngster, who's a 20-year-old Man City fan from Stockport, who's been on their books for a while, and everyone's talked him up. And really, yesterday felt like a coming-of-age moment for him. Pep Guardiola, the Man City manager, has always held him back a bit, and he's not really started, week in, week out. And everyone's been clamouring for get this kid on because he looks so good. But Pep knows best, because he's been holding him back, and this season, it just feels like he's coming into his own. And he was brilliant yesterday, and he destroyed Liverpool.
4-1.
4-1. They won. And for Liverpool, obviously defending champions, the third home defeat on the trot. Now, remember, they'd gone something like almost 4 years without
it was an impregnable fortress.
I said that once. It was once.
You said it once. You only need to say it once on this podcast, and it's held against you, mate.
I said it was an impregnable fortress when it was.
Yeah, not now.
Not now.
So the fortress has been... This is a bit of a crisis, isn't it, for Liverpool? Because now it seems they're not really in the hunt
not
for
sure.
the championship. No. They're now in the hunt to make sure they're in the top four.
They just need to focus on finishing in the top four now, yeah. You know, they're 10 points behind Man City, who have a game in hand, so effectively 13 points off the top. So, yeah, their focus will be on trying to regroup, not hoping that the season doesn't fall apart, really. I mean, you know, as I say, three defeats on the bounce at home, that's not happened since 1963.
Pretty bad.
So it's pretty bad. So, yes, they need to stop the rot.
And I did notice, I heard it on the radio, I hadn't watched it, of course, because I forgot it was on. England lost to Scotland in the rugby.
They did.
And was it in Scotland or in Twickenham?
I'm afraid it's at Twickenham.
Oh, dear.
Albeit an empty Twickenham, obviously.
Yeah.
But still, you know, the worst performance I can remember from an England.
Oh, really?
Most observers said the same. Clive Woodward, writing in our pages, said it was the worst performance he can remember.
What went wrong then?
Well, yet again, it was this insistence on kicking the ball rather than playing running rugby. So they've become this team who, whenever they get the ball, wherever they are, they prefer to kick the ball ahead and try to gain territory, try to gain possession further up the field than actually doing what probably comes naturally to a lot of them. It almost feels like a lot of people are saying they're being overcoached. So when you get the ball in this position, don't use your flair, don't use your imagination, don't be intuitive, do what we have coached you on. And so, yes, on Saturday there were lots of chances where they could have passed the ball, they could have run it in, they could have played exciting rugby, the sort that we'd like to watch them play.
Mm.
And instead they kicked the ball away, lost possession. Scotland were brilliant. Scotland were superb.
Yeah.
And England, you know, their only defence is that a lot of their players, the Saracens players, because they've been relegated to the league below, haven't played much rugby.
Right.
So some of them looked...
Pretty pathetic excuse.
Pretty pathetic excuse. You know, these are well-paid sports stars who, you know, frankly... could get their act together, you know, and some would say, well, having the time off actually is a benefit because they've been, you know, they're not being flogged here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah.
So it depends how you look at that. But it was a really bad performance. Eddie Jones took full responsibility afterwards, said it was all his fault.
Mm.
But, and you know, England will bounce back because they're playing Italy at the weekend, so they'll beat Italy.
Even I could beat them.
Even you could beat Italy on your own.
Yeah.
So they'll bounce back, but it was really demoralising.
Mm.
And as I say, you know, one of the worst performances, if not the worst, that I can remember.
So we need England's cricketers to keep our spirits up, and they're doing all right, aren't they?
The glorious sport of cricket to the rescue. They are. They're doing very well.
How many did they get in that first innings? 500 and something.
So they got 570 in the first
innings.
Is that
nearly a record for a test team abroad?
I mean, they have got more, but it's a very good effort, you know, in alien conditions, and obviously all led by the captain, Joe Root.
Mm.
Who got another double 100.
Amazing, isn't he?
He is amazing. He's in superb form.
And he made that great catch.
Oh, he did, yes. You're right. Blimey, you have been paying attention.
It was on the news.
Talk me through it.
No, that's it. He dived like that.
He did dive like that. It was a brilliant one-handed catch to his left. So, yeah, he set the team up with that first innings. We then bowled India out for about 250 behind.
Mm.
England got another 200, roughly.
Yeah.
So now India, on the final day, which is tomorrow, need 420 to win, which they won't do. Now, England have been criticised in some quarters today for leaving their declaration too late. Now, we don't need to get into the technicalities, but they've given themselves a day to take nine wickets because they took one before the close.
Oh, did they?
If they don't do it and they run out of time, they will be criticised in some quarters for being too cautious. But let's see what happens.
Because if they declared a few hours earlier,
they'd have had more time.
They might have got a few more wickets. Yeah.
But, you know, that's always a balancing act in cricket, because if you declare too early, it gives the opposition time to get the runs.
Right.
So they've batted them out the game.
So at best it will be a draw, but we might win.
I think we will win, and, you know, outside chance.
Another Matt Gatwood prediction.
That we will.
Liverpool, Anfield, an impregnable fortress. They've lost their last three home games. Liverpool to be the champions. They're now fighting to stay in the top four.
So unfair.
You heard it here first.
So
he
unfair.
Says we're going to win the cricket tomorrow, which means get down the bookies. It's an India victory. Lovely to talk to you, Matt.
My pleasure.
Matt Gatwood, Deputy Sports Editor. Could television be the answer for soothing stressed-out cats and entertaining bored dogs? Weirdly, a company has launched Netflix for Pets, or Petflix, which already has 46 million users around the world, with soothing music and images to help pets relax. I'm joined now by Armin Ahmed, who's the chief executive of Music for Pets. Now, tell me about this, Armin. How did you come across the idea that music actually can get a stressed out dog, or even I have had cats for 30 years, a stressed out cat, make them a little bit calmer and easier to manage?
Yeah, thank you for having me. So, yeah, it was around about like 8 years or 9 years ago when we're looking into like music therapy, and the impact it has on pets and different frequencies and different like visuals. And then it was just a just experimenting from there. And as we started creating and defining our content, that's when it just started getting bigger on social media, especially YouTube. And then from there, our fan base got bigger. And then it was just a huge feedback loop of collecting more data and knowing what works and what doesn't work. But everything we did, we created all our content in-house. So like my music producer, the team there, they're based in El Salvador. And then the rest of the content team is in different countries producing content.
And is there a certain type of music that will work for a certain breed of dog? How does it work?
Yeah, so every dog is so individual. There's a reason why we create such a large library of content. But one thing that we have noticed as a trend is reggae music, but an altered version of reggae music that we create in-house. And there was actually scientific studies done, I think, in Scotland, around reggae music and the impact it has on dogs, and that seems to be the best. But what we've done is we've created different frequencies that are more friendly to dog hearing, and it just gives the perfect balance of music where it calms the state of your dog but doesn't put them to sleep in that sense. So
dogs like Bob Marley.
They do, exactly, yeah. So that seems to be the best version.
And what about cats? Now, I've been a cat man for 30 years, and there was a phase when my cats were younger. If the TV was on and they saw birds flying across the TV screen, they'd go around the back of the television looking to pounce, because they're murderers, they're killers, they're very predatory.
Exactly.
But they went out of that phase, and I'm not sure if I played the music, they would give a fig, really. They would just think, where's the food? And, you know, that's the end of it. I mean, are cats as susceptible, do you think?
They are harder.
Are they?
They are very individual creatures.
Yeah.
But that is, once again, through a range of experimenting with different audio and content, as you mentioned earlier, with like birds on the screen, for example. It does work, and it does keep cats entertained. Once again, on that side, millions of cats are using our content.
Right.
But for sure, they are individual in their sense, so they are harder to please than dogs.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
And if people wanted to try this out on their pooch or their moggy, how do they find you?
Yeah, so they can check it out. So relaxmydog.com, relaxmycat.com, or you can go on YouTube and just search Relax My Dog or Relax My
Right.
Cat.
Yeah.
And there's loads of content on there for you to try.
And if you had to say with dogs, is there a particular certain song that would always get the attention of most dogs? Is there one in particular, or one particular artist that would particularly grab a dog, do you think? We've already talked about reggae, for instance.
Yeah, it is very difficult to say because dogs are so individual in that sense. But what we've noticed as a trend for the type of content that we create in-house, it is generally like reggae or classical. Are the two genres of content that is the most popular for us.
And would it be soothing classical, or would it be something stirring like Beethoven or the Ninth Symphony, Ode to Joy or something, which I adore, but I don't think Ode to Joy would calm a dog very much.
It
might get him yapping all over the place.
Exactly, yeah. So it would be soothing. But once again, all the music that we create in-house. And so we, for example, if it's classical, like we'll see what the inspiration, the best bits are from there, but we create everything in-house that's always specifically designed for dogs and humans to enjoy together, because, a dog is going to feed from the energy of the owner as well. So if they're relaxed, that also helps. So that's something that we've noticed, as even our dog TV, that dogs and their human owners are consuming the content together.
Right. So what are you going to do to persuade my cats to adore like their dad does? That's me, ABBA. How can you persuade them?
Well, yeah, ABBA, that is a difficult one.
Oh, come on. Thank you for the music. Won't the cats be pleased with a song like that being played into their...
Have a
go, Armand. If you manage to convince dogs or cats that ABBA is the way to relax, I'll be signing up to you straight away.
And give it a try, yeah.
All right,
I think that'd be difficult for us.
All right, then. Yeah, okay. You see, I think ABBA walk on water, so nothing should be too difficult. That's Armand Ahmed, who's great fun, and he is Chief Executive Officer of Music for Pets. Why don't you try it out? That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, why don't you download the Mail Plus app? Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.